This is episode 2 of Nothing Human Being Something Extra, a Nothing Human bonus episode. 2020 Hindblindness.
Nothing Human Being Something.
Welcome to Nothing Human Being Something Extra, an eclectic bonus collection of shorter form reflections and connections with a focus, as always, on making complex information more accessible to the sincerely curious. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. You can find all the episodes for Being Something Extra and the Nothing Human podcast on my website, nothinghumanpodcast.com. If you would be willing to support me and my family in this work for as little as $5 a month, please visit my Patreon at the link in the show notes to become a supporter, and we thank you very much for that. Even the most important figures, empires, and movements in ancient history seem to appear in the international timeline seemingly fully formed and virtually out of nowhere. It's one of the odd features of our history, but it makes sense when you think about it. Why would the world talk about something until it is already proved important on the world stage? And by the time anything proves important, we haven't necessarily kept any good records of its origins. So even empires as world-changing as Greece or Rome don't appear in histories until after they are already something worth talking about. And by that time, many of the records of how they became important in the first place simply don't exist. No one knew it would be important to talk about the inconsequential lives of some Italian rustics mostly farming away their days, building little city-states like so many others. And the period before the well-known emergence of classical Greece is often called the Greek Dark Ages. Some classical Greek historians, struggling to find the seeds of their very apparent then importance, talked about the Dorian invasion, an influx of the descendants apparently of Heracles, son of Zeus, their main god. The Romans, fumbling in the dark to find a foundation for their rise, concocted the story of Romulus and Remus, protected by the god of the river Tiber and suckled together by a she-wolf. In the absence of any real historical record, origin myths abound. We see these same kinds of myths in the childhood stories of great men and women. We pretend, after the fact, that we could have always detected the seeds of greatness in the early lives of the great. But don't you think there could be just as many similar stories from the lives of the obscure? For instance, we have this story from Plutarch concerning Alexander the Great. When ambassadors came from the Persian king while Philip, Alexander's father, was away, Alexander entertained them and spent time with them and impressed them with his friendliness. He asked no childish or trivial questions, but wanted to know about the length of roads in Persia and what the journey from the coast into the interior was like, and also what sort of warrior the king was and how courageous and powerful the Persians were, with the result that they were astonished and considered that Philip's reputation for cleverness was as nothing compared to Alexander's eagerness to achieve great things. I have a really similar story, actually, of finding a book that I had written in when I was 12 years old. It was Treasure Island, and I had received it for my 12th birthday, and I have dated the front page of this, the empty page at the beginning of the book, and I have written in it, "Here be treasure?" question mark, and I drew a pretty badly drawn picture of a pirate finding treasure underneath that title. And then underneath that, I said, "If you find this book at some point in the future, and I am famous, here is my signature when I am 12 years old." And so I wrote my first signature, and I kind of botched it, so I wrote it again and even wrote a little note and said, "Here is it," twice. And I said, "Do not sell this or give it to a museum. Keep it for yourself." Now, at 12 years old, that's what I thought about my future greatness and the recognition of history on my life. But consider there are probably tons of kids with similar delusions of grandeur, and I probably will not become famous. And if someone finds that book, it will just be yet another sign of people's delusions from the past, if it's ever even found, because it probably wouldn't be. Now, on the other hand, if I am greatly famous, someone's going to go and look at that book and say, "See, the signs of that greatness were always there." And similarly, after the fact, this early sign of Alexander's ambition and precociousness seems pregnant with portent. But again, how many curious and ambitious young boys and royal families eventually come to nothing? Do we remember stories of their promising childhood if their promise never realizes? If Alexander had not become Alexander the Great, would such a story as this even be considered noteworthy? Certainly, the life of someone as important to Plutarch as Alexander the Great must have had obvious and auspicious signs in his time, marking out his future greatness. And if we cannot find them, then we will make them up. It seems clear that we reconstruct the past to confirm our present distributions of importance and value. One could even say we fabricate the past to match our present values, which is why we use mythology to fill in the missing gaps, all the vast portions we didn't in their time think important to record. In this way, most ancient history proves itself more fiction than fact, yet we must accept it. For certainly we cannot deny that Alexander was great, that Rome was a world-conquering empire, or that Greece was the birthplace of Western philosophy and much of our culture. Being so important to us, we believe they must have been planted with the seeds of glory. And we too have only scraps of this past, even the ones we find important, most of which has not been preserved. We preserve also only what we still think has importance. So Aristotle, Alexander the Great's tutor, as it happens, nearly vanishes in the European eye for hundreds of years in our so-called Dark Ages, preserved only during that age by Muslim scholars who valued him still. And who is Aristotle, really, but what we have kept of him and made of what we have kept? And how many empires, Elam, the Sea Peoples, Atlantis, Canaan, barely even leave a scrap to remember them by? Yet in their time, they kept their chronicles. They were sure, given their importance in their time, that they would last and not be destroyed or erased from history. They never could have imagined themselves so unimportant to us as to not even be reconstructed in books as more than mists and fables and myth. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 7, "In the day of prosperity, be happy, but in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man will not discover anything that will be after him." And then, in that same chapter later, he writes, "What has been is remote and exceedingly deep. Who can discover it?" So, to Solomon, the past was as inscrutable as the future, and discerning them was actually the same endeavor. You must actually know the future to know the past. Don't you see this? Because we don't know what will be important, so we don't know what to take note of now. Most of our clarity concerning the past is not 20/20 hindsight, as we say, all looking back after the fact to search for the threads of what you currently think matters is just 20/20 hind blindness, just recreating the past in our own image. And the more confident you are of something's current importance, the more clearly you think you see it, the more foolishly fictitious your history will become, fables and origin myths and tall tales, Washington with his cherry tree, Lincoln with the penny he will eventually grace, FDR by his fireside saving the world. Ozymandias in his prime you are. "Look on my works, ye mighty, in despair," you say. And who knows if anything of your certainty will remain in the distant mists of history. The only history, actually, that has any meaning is prophecy that comes to pass, even when everyone fights it, when none but powerless people want it fulfilled. And I'm not talking about the self-fulfilling prophecy of the weird sisters of Macbeth or the oracles of Delphi, but rather like the prophecy of Oedipus, that you meet on your journey to avoid it. The Hebrew Old Testament is divided into three parts: the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings. Most do not consider that most of the history of the Old Testament is included not in the Writings, but actually in the Prophets. Most of the history of the Old Testament is prophecy more than history as we know it. And doesn't that make sense? The Israelite people were a people so obscure in their day, even at their greatest point, as to barely register in the scraps of the secular histories that have survived from their time. Egypt's extant chronicles barely mention them. Assyria and Babylon barely paid them any mind. In the Old Testament itself, in Deuteronomy 7, Moses makes this very point. He says, Yahweh did not set his love on you, nor choose you, because you were greater than all of the peoples, for you were the least of all peoples. Indeed. Yet, remarkably, the Bible is without any peer the most complete and well-preserved history of any people from that time. It is the most important ancient history of any people without any close second. And it is not a chronicle of important or great people or of international victories or strings of successes, but mostly it is a chronicle of wandering and grasping and failing, of despised and easily despisable individuals who lived their lives from beginning to end as vagabonds and losers, malcontents and wanderers, insignificant and usually barely holding on. Why would anyone write and preserve this but for the confident hope of a promise, of a prophecy? And Jesus, too, was so obscure in his day that he barely warrants a mention in the contemporary secular histories. As far as secular historians are concerned, Christianity seems to appear fully formed once it gains international importance hundreds of years or so after Jesus died. We too would have to create myths of its auspicious origin if we didn't have these mundane records of a man, a simple man, who lived obscure and died rejected, naked, a criminal, who performed miracles perhaps, but even they for such small people, who wrote no books and held no land or places of human power, whose disciples were all, even by their own report, nobodies, and often very stupid and faltering. This Jesus maybe gets a couple mentions from Roman historians, Tacitus, who mentions his death, and then Suetonius, perhaps who read it in Tacitus, misspelling Jesus' title as Crestus. A criminal record and a typo are all Jesus gets in any history outside the Bible in his generation. And yet, the New Testament is not history looking back, but prophecy looking forward. For who can deny now that this Jesus, obscure in his time, marked as no one in his day, and recorded by his followers only on faith and a promise, is by far the most important person of all time, by whose very existence we divide the hemispheres of all human history.
Nothing human being something.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half-sunk a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions red which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch.